Nick walks over to the south side of the walkway. You see that bus? About half a block down there? Philip sees it. A hulking silver MARTA bus sitting at the curb. Nick says, Look above the bus's front door, by the mirror on the right side. You see that mark? Sure enough, Philip sees a hand-drawn symbol above the passenger entrance. A hastily scrawled 5-point star done in red spray paint. What am I looking at? It's a safe zone. A what? Been working my way down that street and up this one back here, Nick tells him, with the innocent pride of a kid showing a soapbox derby model to his dad. There's a barbershop over there, clean as a whistle, secure as a bank, the door unlocked. He points farther up the street. There's an empty semi-trailer up there, ways, in good shape, just sitting there with a good strong, accordion door, on the back end. What's the point here, Nicky? Safe zones, place you can duck into. If you're on a supply run and you get in trouble or whatever, I'm finding them farther and farther down the street, putting marks on them so we don't miss them. There's all sorts of cubby holes out there, you wouldn't believe it. Philip looks at him. You been going all the way down to the end of that street by yourself? Yeah. You know, God damn it, Nick. You shouldn't be going all the way out there without any backup. Feel it. No. Don't just fill me on this, man. I'm serious. I want you to be more careful. You understand? I'm serious about this. Okay, you're right. Nick gives Philip a good-natured punch in the arm. I hear you. Good. You gotta admit, though, this place rocks. Considering the situation we're in. Philip shrugs, looking down through the grimy glass at the cannibal fish circling. Yeah, I guess.
Could be a lot worse, Philly. We're not in the tall buildings. It's flat enough around here for you to see your way around. We got plenty of room to spread out of the apartment building. We got stores with supplies within walking distance. I'm even thinking we could find a generator somewhere. Maybe a hot wire or a car to get it back. I could see us staying here, Philly. I don't know, for a long time.
He thinks about it some more.
Indefinitely, you know?
Philip gazes through the filthy glass at the necropolis of empty buildings and the ragged monsters meandering in and out of view. Everything's indefinite nowadays, Nicky. That night, Brian's cough returns. The weather is getting colder and damper by the day, and it's taking a toll on Brian's immune system. After dark, the apartment is freezing. By morning, it's an icebox, the floor like a skating rink on the soles of Brian's stocking feet. He's taken to wearing 3 layers of sweaters and a knit scarf that Nick procured from Dillard's. With his fingerless gloves and his thatch of unruly black hair, and his hollow Edgar Allan Poe eyes, Brian is starting to look like a waif from a Charles Dickens novel.
I think this place is really good for Penny,
Brian says to Philip that night on a second floor balcony. The Blake brothers are having an after-dinner drink, more of the cheap wine, and gazing out at the desolate skyline. The cool evening air rustles their hair, and the zombie stink wafts just under the smell of rain. Brian stares out at the distant silhouettes of dark buildings as if in a trance. For a person in 21st century America, it's almost incomprehensible to see a great metropolis completely dark. But that's exactly what the Blakes are looking at. A skyline so dead and black it looks like a mountain range on a moonless night. Every few moments, Brian thinks he sees the faint glint of a fire or a light twinkling in the black void, but it could very easily be his imagination.
I think that gal April is the thing that's doing the most good for Penny, Philip says.
Yeah, she's really good with her.
Brian is also growing fond of April, and has been noticing that Philip may very well have a bit of a crush on her as well. Nothing would make Brian happier than to have Philip find a little peace right now. A little stability with a girlfriend.
That other one's a slice, though, ain't she? Philip says.
Tara? Yeah. Not a happy camper.
For the past few days, Brian has been generally avoiding Tara Chalmers. She's a walking ulcer. Always irritable, paranoid, still in the throes of grief over her dad. But Brian figures she'll eventually work her way through it.
She seems like a decent person. The girl does not realize I saved her fucking life, Philip says.
Brian lets out a series of dry coughs. Then he says,
I've been meaning to talk to you about that.
Philip looks at him.
What? The old man turning like that?
Brian measures his words. He knows he's not the only one worrying about this. Ever since David Chalmers came back from the dead and tried to devour his oldest daughter, Brian has been ruminating about the phenomenon and the implications of what happened and the rules of this savage new world and maybe even the prognosis for the entire human race.
Think about it, Philip. He didn't get bit, right?
No, he didn't.
So why did he turn?
For a moment, Philip just stares at Brian, and the darkness seems to expand around them. The city seems to stretch into infinity like the landscape of a dream. Brian feels goose flesh on his arms as though the very act of putting it into words, saying it out loud, has unleashed a malevolent genie from a bottle. And they will never, ever be able to put that genie back. Philip sips his wine. In the darkness, his face is grim and set. Hell of a lot we don't know. Maybe he got infected with something earlier, maybe came into contact with just enough of it to start working on a system. The old man was on his way out anyway.
If that's true, then we all,
hey, Professor, give it a rest. We're all healthy, and we're gonna stay that way.
I know, I'm just saying, maybe we ought to think about taking more precautions.
What precautions? I got your precautions right here. He touches the stock of his .22 caliber Ruger stuffed behind his belt.
I'm talking about washing up better, sterilizing stuff.
With what? Brian lets out a sigh and looks up at the overcast night sky, a low canopy of haze as dark as black wool. Autumn rains are brewing.
We got the water upstairs in the toilets, he says.
We got the filters and the propane, and we got access to cleaning products down the street, soaps and cleansers and shit. We're already filtering the water sport.
Yeah, but, and we're washing up with that contraption Nicky found.
The so-called contraption is an outdoor camp shower that Nick found in Dillard's sporting goods department. About the size of a small cooler, it has a collapsible 5-gallon tank and a shower hose that operates off a battery-powered pump. For 5 days now, they've each been enjoying the periodic luxury of a brief shower, recycling the water as much as possible.
I know, I'm just saying maybe it's like better to go overboard right now with the cleanliness, that's all, until we know more.
Philip gives him a hard look.
And what if there ain't nothing more to learn?
Brian has no answer for that one. The only response comes from the city, humming darkly back at them with a blast of foul-smelling wind and a big, silent fuck you. Maybe it's the alarming conglomeration of unappetizing ingredients concocted that night by April and Penny for dinner, a mixture of canned asparagus, spam, and crumbled potato chips cooked over a propane flame, sitting like a dropped anchor in the pit of Philip's stomach. Or perhaps it's the cumulative effect of all the stress and rage and sleeplessness that does it. Or maybe it's the conversation he had on the balcony with his brother. But regardless of the cause, after he turns in for the night and drifts off into an uneasy sleep, Philip Blake experiences an elaborate and lurid dream. He has the dream in his newly established private quarters. April's former bedroom was apparently once somebody's home office. While clearing out the owner's things, Philip and April found stacks of Mary Kay Cosmetics order forms and makeup samples. But now, lying on the queen-sized bed shoved against the wall, Philip writhes in semi-consciousness, drifting in and out of a feverish horror show. It's the kind of dream that has no shape. It has no beginning, middle, or end. It just keeps spinning in its rut of circular terror. He finds himself back in his childhood home in Waynesboro, the shabby little bungalow on Farrell Street, in the back bedroom he used to share with Brian. Philip is not a child in the dream. He's an adult,
and somehow the plague has time-traveled back to the 1970s. The dream is almost three-dimensionally vivid. There's the Lily of the Valley wallpaper and the Iron Maiden posters, and the scarred school desk, and Brian is somewhere in the house, unseen, screaming. And Penny is also there, in some adjacent room, crying for her daddy. Philip runs through the hallways, which form an endless labyrinth. Plaster is cracking. The zombie horde is outside, clamoring to get in. The boarded windows are trembling. Philip has a hammer and tries to secure the windows with nails, but the head of the hammer falls off. Crashing noises. Philip sees a door cracking open and he rushes over to it, and the doorknob comes off in his hand. He searches drawers and cabinets for weapons, and the facings fall off the cabinets, and plaster sifts down from the ceiling, and his boot breaks through a hole in the floor. The walls are collapsing, and the linoleum is buckling, and the windows are falling from their frames, and Philip keeps hearing Penny's desperate, shrieking voice calling for him. Daddy! Skeletal arms thrust through crumbling window casements, blackened, curled fingers groping. Daddy! Bone-white skulls burst up through the floor like gruesome periscopes. Daddy! Philip lets out a silent scream as the dream shatters apart like spun glass. Chapter 14. Philip gasps awake with a start. He jerks forward on the bed, blinking and squinting at the pale morning light. Someone stands at the foot of his bed. No. Two people. He sees them now. One tall and one short. Good morning, sunshine, April says with her hand around Penny's shoulder. Jesus. Philip sits up against the headboard and his wife beater in sweatpants. What the hell time is it? It's like almost noon. Holy Christ, Philip utters, getting his bearings. His entire sinewy form is filmed with cold sweat. His neck aches and his mouth tastes like a litter box. I can't believe it. We gotta show you something, Daddy, the little girl tells him, her big eyes ablaze with excitement. The sight of his daughter looking so happy sends a soothing wave of relief through Philip, driving the last remnants of the dream from his feverish brain. He gets up and gets dressed, telling the two ladies to calm down. Give me a second to put my face on, he says in a hoarse, whiskey-cured grunt, running fingers through his greasy hair. They take him up to the roof. When they emerge from the fire door and plunge into the cool air and light, Philip balks at the glare. Despite the fact that the day is overcast and dark, Philip is hungover, and the light makes his eyeballs throb. He squints up at the sky and sees the foreboding storm clouds churning and roiling into the area from the north. Looks like rain, he says. That's good, April says, giving Penny a wink. Show him why, honey. The little girl grasps her father's hand and drags him across the roof. Look, Daddy, me and April made a garden to grow stuff in. She shows him a small makeshift planter in the center of the roof. It takes a moment for Philip to realize that the garden is constructed out of four wheelbarrows, their wheels removed, their housings taped together. A 6-inch layer of soil fills each of the four cavities, a few unidentified shoots of green already transplanted into each barrow. This is pretty damn fine, he says, giving the child a squeeze. He looks at April. Pretty damn fine. It was Penny's idea, April says with a little gleam of pride in her eyes. She points at a row of buckets. We're going to collect the rain, too. Philip drinks in April Schaumer's beautiful, slightly bruised face, her seafoam blue eyes, her ashy blonde hair undone and hanging over the collar of her scroungy cable-knit sweater. He can't take his eyes off her. And even as Penny starts jabbering happily about all the things she wants to grow, cotton candy plants, bubblegum bushes, Philip cannot help but extrapolate. The way April kneels down next to the child, listening intently with her hand on Penny's back, the look of affection on the woman's face, the easy rapport between the two, the sense of connection. All of it suggests something deeper than mere survival. Philip can barely allow himself to think the word, and yet it comes to him right then, on that windy precipice in a rush. Family.
Excuse me.
The gruff voice comes from the fire door behind them, on the other side of the roof. Philip whirls. He sees Tara in one of her stained muumuus in one of her patented moods in the open doorway. She holds a bucket. Her heavily jowled face and Maybelline eyes look even more lined and surly than usual.
Would it be too much to ask for a little help?
April rises and turns.
I told you I'd help you in a minute.
Philip can see that Tara has been collecting water from toilet basins. He considers getting in the middle of this, but decides against it.
That was half an hour ago, Tara says. Meantime, I've been lugging water while you've been lollygagging up here in Mr. Rogers' neighborhood.
Tara, just calm down, April sighs. Give me a second, I'll be right there.
Fine. Whatever.
Tara turns in a huff and swishes angrily back down the inner stairs, leaving the sour vibration of contempt in her slipstream. April looks down.
I'm sorry about that.
She's still dealing with, stuff. By the downtrodden expression on April's face, it's clear that it would take too much energy for her to run down the litany of what's needling at her sister. Philip's no dummy. He knows it's complicated and it has something to do with jealousy and sibling rivalry, maybe even the fact that April seems to be going through her grieving period with someone other than Tara.
No need to apologize, Philip tells her. There is something I want you to know, though.
What's that?
Just want you to know how grateful I am. The way you've been treating my daughter.
April smiles.
She's a great kid.
Yes, ma'am, she is. You ain't so bad yourself.
Why, thank you. She leans over and gives Philip a peck on the cheek. Nothing fancy, just a quick little kiss. But it makes an impression. Now I gotta get back before my sister shoots me. April walks off, leaving Philip thunderstruck and reeling in the wind. As kisses go, it wasn't anything special. Philip's late wife Sarah had been a blue ribbon kisser. Hell, Philip had encountered prostitutes over the years since Sarah's death who had given up more in the kissing department. Even hookers of feelings. And Philip would usually ask at the beginning of the session if they would mind terribly if he slipped in a few kisses, just for good measure, just to pretend that there was love involved. But this little smooch of April's is more like hors d'oeuvres, a hint of things to come. Philip wouldn't call it a tease, nor would he call it the platonic kind of kiss a sister might give a brother. It exists in that irresistible limbo between two extremes. It is, from Philip's perspective, a knock on the door, an attempt to see if anyone's home. That afternoon, Philip expects the rain to come, but it doesn't. It's already mid-October, he has no idea what day it is, and everybody keeps expecting the gully washers that traditionally sweep through central Georgia this time of year to roll in, but something keeps them at bay. The temperature is dropping and the air buzzes with latent moisture, but still the rain doesn't come. Maybe the drought has something to do with the plague. But for whatever reason, the unsettled sky with its dark underbelly of storm clouds seems to reflect the strange, inexplicable tension building in Philip. Late in the day, he asks April to go with him on a quick trip down the street. It takes some convincing, despite the fact that the zombie quotient has thinned dramatically since the last time they went out. Philip tells April he needs help scouting the vicinity for a Home Depot or a Lowe's that might have generators lying around. It's getting colder and colder, especially at night, and they're gonna need power soon in order to survive. He says he needs somebody who knows the area. He also tells her that he wants to show her the safe routes Nick has been carving out. Nick offers to go along, but Philip says it would be better if he stuck around and kept watch on the place with Brian. April is up to the task and is willing to go, but she's a little dubious about the rickety homemade catwalk. What if it starts raining when they're on the ladders? Philip assures her it's a piece of cake, especially for a little drink of water her size. They get their coats on and get their weapons ready, April brings along one of the Marlins this time, and they prepare to embark. Tara is seething with anger at them, disgusted by what she calls a stupid, dangerous, immature, retarded waste of time. Philip and April politely ignore her. "Don't look down." Philip is halfway across the makeshift ladder bridge over the back alley. April is 10 feet behind him, holding on for dear life. Gazing over his shoulder at her, he smiles to himself.
"Major cojones on this girl."
"I'm cool," she says, crabbing along with white knuckles and clenched jaw. The wind tousles her hair. 30 feet beneath her, a pair of moving cadavers dumbly gaze around the air for the source of the voices.
"Almost home free," Philip urges as he reaches the other side.
She crabs the remaining 20 feet. He helps her down onto the fire escape landing. The cast iron grating squeaks under their weight. They find the open window and slip inside the former home of Stevenson and Sons Accounting and Estate Planning. The office corridors are darker and colder than they were the last time Philip traversed their length. The storm front has brought dusk to the area earlier than usual tonight. They cross the empty hallways.
"Don't worry," Philip assures her as they crunch across debris and crumpled tax returns. "This place is as safe as you can get, this day and age."
"That's not very reassuring," she says, cradling the shotgun, thumbing the hammer nervously. Dressed in tattered fleece and jeans, April has her arms and lower legs wrapped with gaffer's tape. Nobody else does this. Philip asked her about it once, and she told him she saw an animal trainer do it on TV. A last resort defense against a bite breaking the skin. They cross the lobby and find the access stairs just past the ruined vending machines.
"Get a load of this," Philip says as he leads her up the single flight to the unmarked door.
He pauses before opening the door.
"You remember Captain Nemo?"
"Who?"
"That old flick, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. That old loony captain, playing his organ in that submarine while the giant squids swim across them big picture windows."
"Never saw it." Philip smiles at her.
"Well, you're about to."
The last thing April Chalmers expects is for something other than horrific violence to take her breath away. But that's pretty much what happens when she follows Philip through the unmarked door and onto the pedestrian bridge. She pauses on the threshold and just stares. She's been in these urban breezeways before, maybe even this very bridge. But somehow, tonight, the gauzy light and space of the thing, as it stretches across the intersection 30 feet above the streets, connecting up with the second floor of Dillard's, seems almost miraculous. Through the glass roof, veins of lightning flicker and thread across the storm clouds. Through the transparent walls, the darkening shadows of the city teem with wandering zombies. Atlanta looks like a vast game board in chaotic disarray.
"I see what you mean," she says.
Her voice comes out in a murmur as she takes it all in, feeling a weird mixture of emotions. Giddiness, fear, excitement. Philip strolls down the center of the bridge, pausing by one wall and shrugging off the straps of his duffel bag. He nods to the south.
"Want you to see something," he says.
"Come here." She joins him, putting down her shotgun and backpack against the glass wall. Philip points out the marks on the abandoned vehicles and doorways left by Nick Parsons. Philip explains the theory of safe zones. He talks about how cunning Nick has become.
"I think he's got something really good going here," Philip concludes.
April agrees. "We could use those hiding places when we find that generator everybody's talking about."
"You got that right, sister."
"Nick's a good guy."
"That he is."
The encroaching darkness is drawing down over the city. And in the bluish shadows of the bridgeway, Philip's rugged face looks even craggier to April than usual. With his inky black Fu Manchu whiskers and dark eyes nested in laugh lines, he reminds April of a cross between a young Clint Eastwood and...
who?
Her dad is a young man? Is that why she's feeling these twinges of attraction toward the big, lanky redneck?
Is April so retarded that she's attracted to a man just because he's the doppelganger of her father? Or does this pathetic puppy love have something to do with the stress of fighting to survive in a world suddenly doomed with extinction? This is the guy who cracked open her daddy's skull, for God's sake. But maybe that's unfair. That was not David Chalmers back there. Her daddy's spirit, as the song goes, had flown away. His soul had departed long before he climbed out of his bed and tried to make a meal out of his eldest daughter. I gotta tell you, Philip is saying, gazing out at the ragged figures like stray dogs roaming the streets for scraps. We get a few things in place. We could stay for a long time in that apartment building. I think you're right. All we gotta do is figure out a way to slip some Valium into Tara's oatmeal. Philip laughs. A good, clean laugh. Which shows a side of him that April has not yet seen. He looks at her. We got an opportunity here. We can make this work. We can do more than just survive. I'm not just talking about getting a generator. April looks up into his eyes. What do you mean? He turns toward her. Met a lot of girls in my day. They never run across one quite like you. Tough as nails, but the tenderness you show toward my kid. Never seen Penny take to somebody like she's taken to you. Hell, you saved our asses, pulling us off the streets. You're a very special lady, you know that? All at once, April feels her skin flush hot with chills and her midsection weaken. And she realizes Philip is looking at her in a new way. His eyes shimmer with emotion. She knows now that he's been thinking the same thing that she has. She looks down, embarrassed. Your standards must be low, she mutters. He reaches out and gently puts one of his big, calloused workman's hands on the curve of her jaw. I got the highest standards of anybody I know. A clap of thunder booms outside the glass, rattling the bridge and making April jump. Philip kisses her on the lips. She pulls back. I don't know, Philip. I mean, I don't know if this is, you know. Second thoughts and third thoughts and fourth thoughts flow through April in the space of an instant. If she takes this to the next level, what'll happen with Tara? How will it fuck up the dynamics of the apartment? How will it complicate things? How will it affect their safety, their chances of survival, their future, if they even have one? Philip's expression brings her back. The way he's looking at her. His gaze almost glassy with emotion. His mouth slack with desire. He leans in and kisses her again. And this time she finds herself putting her arms around him and returning the kiss. And she doesn't even notice the droplets of rain beginning to ping off the glass over her head. She feels her body go limp in Philip's forceful embrace. Their lips part, and electricity flows through April as they explore each other with their tongues. The taste of coffee and spearmint gum and Philip's musky odor filling her senses. Her nipples harden under her sweater. A flash of blue lightning turns the dusk to brilliant silver daylight. April loses track of herself. She loses track of everything. Her head is spinning. She doesn't even notice the rain, slapping against the glass roof. She doesn't even notice the fact that Philip is gently lowering both of them to the floor of the walkway. Their lips locked and working sensually. Philip's big hands caressing April's breasts. He carefully lays her back against the glass wall. Before April knows what is happening, he's on top of her. The storm unleashes its fury. The rain comes down now in sheets against the roof. Thunder rolls and lightning crackles and sparks like static electricity in the anxious air as Philip fumbles April's sweater up across her bare midriff, exposing her bra in the blue light. Gnarled fingers wrestle open belt buckles. Thunder booms. April feels the urgent nudge of Philip's loins burrowing between her legs. Lightning flickers. Her jeans are halfway down her legs, her breasts free now. The edge of a fingernail brushes her belly, and all at once, like a switch flipping inside her, accompanied by a single volley of thunder, she thinks, wait. Boom! Wait! A tidal wave of desire carries Philip Blake off on its roaring currents. He can barely hear April's voice coming from somewhere far away, telling him to stop. Wait, hold on. Listen, listen, this is too much. I'm not ready for this, please. Please, stop right now. Stop! None of it registers in Philip's brain as it swims with lust and passion and pain and loneliness and a desperate need to feel something, because now his entire being is wired to his groin, all his pent-up emotion coursing through him. God, I'm begging you to stop! The faraway voice pleads, April's body stiffening. Philip rides the writhing woman beneath him as if surfing a pipeline of white noise, knowing that she secretly wants him, loves him despite what she's saying. So he keeps shoving himself into her again and again in great magnesium bright flashes of lightning and raw energy, filling her, taking her, nourishing her, transforming her, until she goes limp beneath him. Limp and silent now. The soft white explosion of pleasure erupts like a skyrocket launching inside Philip. He slides off her, landing on the floor next to her, staring straight up at the rain, momentarily oblivious to the shadowy, desecrated souls 30 feet below them, captured in the flicker show of lightning, like monstrous figures in a silent movie. Philip takes April's silence as a sign that maybe, just maybe, everything's going to be okay. As the storm settles into a steady deluge, its muffled jet engine roar filling the walkway, the two of them pull their clothes back on and lie there side by side for a long time, not saying a word, staring up at the strafing sheets of rain crashing off the glass roof. Philip is in a state of shock, his heart racing, his skin clammy and cold. He feels like a broken mirror, as if a shard of his own soul is fractured off and reflected back the face of a monster. What did he just do? He knows he did something wrong, but it almost feels like somebody else did it. Got a little carried away there, he says at last, after many minutes of terrible silence. She doesn't say a word. He glances over at her and sees her face in the darkness, reflecting the liquid shadows of rain streaming down the sides of the glass walkway. She looks semi-conscious, like she's having a waking dream. Sorry about that, he says, the words sounding tinny and hollow in his own ears. He shoots another glance at her, trying to gauge her mood. You okay? Yes. You sure? Yes. Her voice has a mechanical quality to it, completely colorless, barely audible above the noise of the rain. Philip is about to say something else when a volley of thunder interrupts his thoughts. The rumbling reverberates through the iron framework of the walkway, a teeth-rattling vibration that makes Philip cringe. April. Yes. We ought to get back. The return trip is shrouded in silence. Philip walks a few paces behind April through the deserted lobby, up a staircase and down the empty, litter-strewn corridors. Every now and then, Philip considers saying something, but he doesn't. He figures it's probably best to let it ride right now. Let her work through it. Anything Philip says might make it worse. April walks ahead of him with the shotgun on her shoulder, looking like a tired soldier returning from a rough patrol. They reach the top floor of the accounting firm and find the gaping window, the rain blowing in past jagged, broken glass. Only a few words are spoken. You go first, and watch your step, as Philip helps her climb out and cross the rain-swept fire escape. The pounding wind and rain that lashes down on them as they shimmy across the treacherous makeshift catwalk almost feels good to Philip. It braces him and wakes him up, and gives him hope that maybe he can repair whatever damage has been done here tonight with this woman. By the time they get back to the apartment, both of them soaked to the bone, exhausted and dazed, Philip is confident he can fix this. Brian is in the office bedroom with Penny, putting her to sleep on her cot. Nick is in the living room working on his map of safe zones. Hey, how'd it go? He asks, looking up from his papers. You guys look like drowned rats. You found any Home Depots out there?
Not this time, Philip replies, heading for the bedroom, not even pausing to take off his shoes. April says nothing, doesn't even meet Nick's gaze as she heads toward the hallway.
Look at you two,
Tara says, coming out of the kitchen with a surly expression and a lit cigarette dangling out of the corner of her mouth.
Just like I thought, a wild fucking goose chase.
She stands there with her hands on her hips as her sister vanishes without a word into her room at the end of the hall. Tara gives Philip a look, and then storms away following her sister. I'm going to bed, Philip says flatly to Nick, and then adjourns to his room. The next morning, Philip stirs awake just before dawn. The rain still pounds the streets outside. He can hear it drumming off the window. The room is dark and cold and dank and smells of mold. He sits on the edge of the bed for the longest time, looking at Penny, who slumbers across the room on her cot, her tiny body all balled up in a fetal position. The half-formed memories of a dream cling to Philip's woozy brain, as well as the sickening sensation that he doesn't know where the nightmares end and the episode with April the previous evening begins. If only he had dreamed those events in the pedestrian walkway instead of actually acting them out. But the hard, sharp edge of reality comes back to him in that dark room in a series of flash frames in his mind, as though he's watching someone else perpetrate the crime. Philip hangs his head, trying to push the feelings of dread and guilt from his mind. Running fingers through his hair, he talks himself into being hopeful. He can work through this with April, figure out a way to move forward, put it behind them, apologize to her, make it up to her. He watches Penny sleep. In the 2.5 weeks since Philip's little cadre joined up with the Chalmers, Philip has noticed his daughter coming out of her shell. At first, he detected little things, the way Penny had begun to look forward to concocting their god-awful dinners, and the way she lit up every time April walked into a room. With each passing day, though, the child has become more and more talkative, remembering things from before the turn, commenting on the strange weather patterns, asking questions about the sickness. Can animals get the disease? Does it wear off? Is God mad at them? Philip's chest hitches with emotion as he gazes at the slumbering child. There has to be a way to make a life for his daughter. Make a family. Make a home. Even in the midst of this waking nightmare. There has to be a way. For a brief instant, Philip imagines a desert island and a little cottage nestled in a grove of coconut trees. The plague is a million light years away. He imagines April and Penny on a swing set, playing together out by a vegetable garden. He imagines himself sitting on a back porch, healthy, brown from the sun, happily watching the two ladies in his life sharing contented moments. He imagines all this while he watches his daughter sleep. He gets up and pads over to her, kneeling and lightly putting a hand on the downy softness of her hair. She needs to bathe. Her hair is matted and greasy, and she has a faint body odor. That smell somehow reaches out to Philip and pinches his gut. His eyes well up. He has never loved anyone other than this child. Even Sarah, whom he adored, came in second. His love for Sarah was like that of all married people, complicated, conditional, and fluid. But when he first laid eyes on his baby girl as a blotchy little newborn 7.5 years ago, he learned what it means to love. It means to be afraid, to be vulnerable for the rest of your life. Something catches Philip's attention across the room. The door is half ajar. He remembers shutting it before turning in. He remembers that very clearly. Now it's cracked open about 6 inches. At first, this doesn't really make much of an impression or worry him all that much. Maybe he accidentally neglected to latch the door and the thing drifted open on its own. Or maybe he got up to piss in the middle of the night and forgot to close it. Or maybe Penny had to pee and left it open. Hell, maybe he's a sleepwalker and doesn't even know it.
But then, just as he's turning back to continue gazing down at his daughter, he notices something else. Things are missing from the room. Philip's heart starts thumping. He left his backpack, the one he was wearing when he arrived here over 2 weeks ago, leaning against the wall in the corner, but now it's gone. His gun is missing as well. He left the .22 pistol on top of the dresser with the last magazine of bullets beside it. The ammo is gone, too. Philip springs to his feet. He looks around. The gloomy dawn is just beginning to lighten the room, the window shade projecting tears of rain, the ghostly reflections of water sluicing down the glass outside it. His boots are not where he left them. He left them on the floor by the window, but now they're gone. Who the hell would take his boots? He tells himself to calm down. There has to be a simple explanation. No reason to get all jacked up. But the absence of the gun is what troubles him the most. He decides to take this one step at a time. Silently, careful not to awaken Penny, he crosses the room and slips out the open door. The apartment is silent and still. Brian dozes in the living room on the pull-out bed. Philip pads into the kitchen, lights up the propane stove, and makes himself a cup of instant coffee with some rainwater left in a bucket. He splashes some of the cold water on his face. He tells himself to stay calm, take some deep breaths. When the coffee is hot, he takes the cup and walks down the hallway to April's room. Her door is also ajar. He looks in and sees that the room is empty. His pulse quickens. A voice says, "She ain't here." He whirls and comes face to face with Tara Chalmers, who holds the Ruger pistol, the muzzle raised, and aimed directly at Philip. Chapter 15. "All right. Go easy, sis." Philip makes no move. He just stands there, frozen in the hallway, with his free hand raised, and the coffee in his other hand jutting out to the side like he's interested in offering it to her. "Whatever it is, we can work it out."
"Really?"
Tara Chalmers glowers at him with her painted eyes flaring.
"You think?"
"Look, I don't know what's going on."
"What's going on?" she says without a trace of nerves or fear. "Is how we're changing the lineup around here."
"Tara, whatever you're thinking,
let's get something straight."
Her voice is steady and flatlined of emotion.
"I need you to shut the fuck up and do what I say, or I will blow you the fuck away, and don't think I won't. This ain't put the cup down."
Philip obliges, slowly setting the cup on the floor.
"Okay, sis, whatever you say."
"Stop calling me that."
"Yes, ma'am."
"Now we're gonna go get your brother, your friend, and your kid."
Philip buzzes with adrenaline. He doesn't think Tara has the balls to do any real harm, and he considers making a move for the weapon. A distance of 6 to 8 feet lies between him and the barrel of the Ruger, but he resists the temptation. Better to comply at this point and try and get her talking.
"May I say something?"
"Move!" Her sudden cry shatters the stillness, loud enough to not only awaken Penny and Brian, but probably be heard up on the second floor where Nick, an early riser, is likely already up and about. Philip takes a step toward her.
"If you just give me a chance to—"
The Ruger barks. The blast goes wide, maybe on purpose, maybe not, chewing a divot in the wall 18 inches from Philip's left shoulder. The roar of the gun is enormous in the enclosed space of the hallway, and Philip's ears are ringing as he realizes a particle of the plaster wall is stuck to his cheek. He can barely see Tara through the blue smoke of cordite. She's either grinning or grimacing. It's hard to tell at this point.
"The next one goes in your face," she tells him. "Now, you gonna be a good boy or what?"
Nick Parsons hears the gunfire just after opening his Concordance Bible for his morning read. Sitting in bed, with his back against the headboard, he jumps at the noise, the Bible flying out of his hands. It was open to the revelation to John, chapter 1, verse 9, the part where John says to the church, "I am John, your brother, who shares with you in Jesus the tribulation and the kingdom and patient endurance." Leaping out of bed,
He goes to the closet where his Marlin shotgun is supposed to be resting against the wall in the corner, except it's not there. Panic vibrates down through Nick's spine, and he spins and he looks around his room at all the missing gear. His knapsack, gone. His boxes of shotgun shells, gone. His tools, his pickaxe, his boots, his maps, all gone. At least his jeans are still there, neatly folded over the back of a chair. He yanks them on and charges out of the room. Through the studio apartment, out the door, down the corridor, down a flight of steps and out into the first floor. He thinks he hears the sound of a voice raised in anger, but he's not sure. He rushes toward the Chalmers apartment. The door is unlocked and he pushes his way inside. "What's going on? What's going on?" Nick keeps repeating as he slams to a stop in the living room. He sees something that doesn't make any sense. He sees Tara Chalmers with the Ruger pointed at Philip, and Philip with this weird look on his face, and Brian standing a few feet away with Penny drawn close to him, his arms around the little girl in a protective posture. And weirder still, Nick sees their belongings piled on the floor in front of the sofa. "Move over there," Tara says, brandishing the gun and directing Nick toward Philip, Brian, and Penny. "What's wrong?" "Never mind, just do what I say." Nick slowly complies, but his mind is swimming with confusion. What in God's name happened here? Almost involuntarily, Nick looks at Philip, looks into the big man's eyes for answers. But for the first time since Nick has known Philip Blake, the big guy looks almost sheepish, almost blank with indecision and frustration. Nick looks at Tara. "Where's April? What happened?" "Never mind." "What are you doing? What's the idea of putting all our stuff at Nicky?" Philip chimes in. "Let it go. Tara's gonna tell us what she wants us to do. And we're gonna do it, and everything's gonna be okay." Philip says this to Nick, but as he's saying it, he's looking at Tara. "Listen to your pal here, Nick," Tara says. And she too says this to Nick, but doesn't take her gaze off Philip. Her eyes practically glow with contempt and anger and vengeance and something else. Something incomprehensible to Nick. Something that feels disturbingly intimate. Now it's Brian's turn to pipe in. "What is it you want us to do exactly?" Tara still doesn't take her eyes off Philip as she says, "Get out." At first, this simple imperative sentence sounds to Nick Parsons like a rhetorical statement. To his stunned ears, it sounds as though she's not exactly telling them to do something, as much as she's making some kind of point. But this initial reaction, and maybe hopeful thinking, is immediately short-circuited by the look on Tara Chalmers' face. "Hit the road." Philip keeps staring at her. "Where I come from, that's called murder. Call it whatever you want. Just take your shit and go. You're gonna send us out there without weapons. I'm gonna do more than that," she says. "I'm gonna climb up on that roof with one of them high-powered pigeon guns, and I'm gonna make sure you leave." After a long, horrible moment of silence, Nick looks at Philip. And finally, Philip tears his gaze away from the stout, buxom girl with the pistol. "Get your stuff," he says to Nick. And then to Brian he says, "There's a rain poncho in my pack. Put it on Penny." The amount of time it takes them to get dressed and ready to leave is nominal, mere minutes, with Tara Chalmers standing guard like a stone sentry. But it gives Brian Blake plenty of time to wildly ruminate to himself about what could have happened. Tying his boots and putting the slicker on Penny, he realizes that all indications point to some kind of sick triangle going on. April's absence speaks volumes, as does Tara's unmitigated righteous anger. But what caused it? It couldn't be something Philip said or did. What could offend the girls this deeply? For a crazy instant, Brian's mind casts back to his insane ex-wife. Compulsive, volatile, flaky Jocelyn had done stuff like this. She would vanish without a trace for weeks. One time, while Brian was at night school, she actually put all his shit out on the stairs of their tenement building, as though she were removing a stain from her life. But this is different. The Chalmers girls have shown no previous signs of being irrational or nuts. The thing that bothers Brian the most is the way his brother is behaving. Beneath the surface of his simmering anger and frustration, Philip Blake almost seems resolved. Maybe even hopeless. This is a clue. This is important. But the problem is there's no time to figure it out. Come on, let's roll, Philip says, his backpack slung over his shoulder. He has his denim jacket on now, the black, oily grime and gore from their earlier journey still visible all over it, and he's heading toward the door. Wait, Brian says. He turns to Tara. At least let us take some food, for Penny's sake. She just levels her gaze at him and says, I'm letting you walk out here alive. Come on, Brian. Philip pauses in the doorway. It's over. Brian looks at his brother. Something about that deeply lined, weathered face is galvanizing to Brian. Philip is family, he's blood, and they've come a long way. They've survived too many jams to die now like homeless pets abandoned on the side of the road. Brian feels a strange sensation building the base of his spine, filling him with an unexpected strength. Fine, he says. If this is the way it has to be... He doesn't finish the sentence. There's nothing more to say. He simply puts an arm around Penny and ushers her out behind her father. The rain is both a blessing and a curse. It bullwhips across their faces as they emerge from the building's front entrance, but as they crouch under spindly trees along the parkway to get their bearings, they see that the storm has apparently driven the biters off the streets. The sewers are flooding, the roads streaming with overflow, and the gray sky hangs low. Nick squints into the distance to the south, the streets relatively clear. That way is best. Most of the safe zones are down there. Okay, we'll head south, Philip says and turns to Brian. Can you piggyback her again? I'm counting on you, sport. Watch your back. Brian wipes moisture from his face and gives his brother a thumbs up. Turning to the child, Brian starts to go about the business of gently lifting her onto his back, but he abruptly stops. For the briefest instant, he just stares in amazement at the little girl. She is also giving a thumbs-up sign. Brian glances at his brother, and the two men acknowledge something beyond words. Penny Blake just stands there, waiting, chin jutting defiantly. Her soft little eyes are blinking away the rain, and the look on her face is reminiscent of the expression her late mother would often display when impatient with male nonsense. Finally, the child says, I'm not a baby. Can we go now? They make their way to the corner, staying low, slipping on the slimy walk, the rain a constant drag on their progress. It gets in their faces and in their clothes and into their joints almost immediately. It's an icy, needling autumn rain with no signs of slowing down. Up ahead, a few shabby, cadaverous zombies cluster near an abandoned bus stop, their greasy heads of hair like moss matted across their dead faces. They look like they're waiting for a bus that will never come. Philip leads his group across the corner and under an awning. Nick points the way to the first safe zone, the city bus sitting in mothballs half a block south of the pedestrian bridge. A quick hand gesture from Philip, and now they hurry along the storefronts toward the bus. I say we go back, Nick Parsons is grumbling as he crouches down on the floor of the bus and fishes through his backpack. The rain makes a muffled Tommy gun noise on the bus's roof. Nick finds a t-shirt, pulls it out, and wipes the moisture from his face. We're talking about a single girl here. We can take the place back from her. I say we go back and kick her the hell out. Think we can take it from her, huh? Philip is up in the pilot area, searching the compartments for things left behind by the driver. You got a bulletproof vest in that backpack of yours. The bus, a 30-foot fuselage of molded seats facing inward along either side, reeks with the ghostly secretions of former passengers, a sort of wet dog fur smell. In the rear of the bus, resting on the second-to-last seat, with Penny in the seat next to him, Brian shivers in his wet sweatshirt and jeans. He has a bad feeling. and it's not only because of their exposure to the stormy urban wilderness of Atlanta. Brian's sense of doom has more to do with the mystery of what happened back at the apartment building last night. He can't stop wondering just exactly what transpired between the hours of 5 p.m. when Philip and April embarked on their mission, and 5 a.m. the following morning, when everything suddenly blew up in their faces. From the gravelly tension in his brother's voice and the cold determination on his face, it's becoming clear to Brian that it may already be a moot point. Their immediate priority is now survival. But Brian can't stop thinking about it. The mystery speaks to something deeper, something gnawing at Brian to which he can't quite put words. Lightning flashes outside the bus, as brilliant as a photographer's strobe.
"We had a good thing going at that place,"
Nick goes on, his voice whiny and unsteady. He stands up, grabbing a hand strap for purchase.
"Those are guns, man. All the work we did, that's our stuff as much as theirs."
"Stay down, Nick," Philip says flatly. "I don't want any of them puss bags seeing us in here."
Nick ducks down. Philip sits down in the driver's seat, the spring squeaking. He checks a map case on the dash and finds nothing useful. The keys are in the ignition. Philip turns it over and gets nothing but a clicking noise.
"I'm not going to say it again. That place is over for us."
"Why, though? Why can't we take it back, Philly? We can take that fat bitch, the three of us."
"Let it go, Nick," Philip says. And even Brian, all the way in the back of the bus, hears the icy warning tone in Philip's voice.
"I just don't get it," Nick complains under his breath. "How something like this could happen?"
Bingo. At last, Philip has found something useful. The 4-foot-long steel rod, about the width and heft of a short length of iron rebar, is attached to clips under the driver's side window. Hooked on one end, the tool is likely used to reach across the cab to the accordion door in order to manually pull it shut. Now, as Philip wields the thing in the gloomy light, it looks like an excellent makeshift weapon.
"This'll do," he murmurs.
"How did this happen, Philly?"
Nick persists, crouching down in the flickering stutter of lightning.
"God damn it!"
Philip suddenly slams the iron rod against the dash, sending shards of plastic flying and making everybody jump. He smacks it again, cracking the two-way radio. He strikes it again and again with all his might, caving in the controls and shattering the fare box, sending coins flying. He keeps striking the console until the dashboard is totaled. Finally, with the veins in his neck bulging, his face livid with rage, he turns and burns his gaze into Nick Parsons.
"Would you please shut the fuck up?"
Nick stares. In the rear of the bus, sitting next to Brian, Penny Blake turns away and gazes out the window, the dirty rain tracking down in rivulets. Her expression hardens as though she's working out a complicated mathematical problem that's far too complex for her grade level. Meanwhile, up front, Nick is frozen with shock.
"Take it easy, Philly. I'm just babbling, you know? Didn't mean anything. The place just kind of grew on me."
Philip licks his lips. The fire in his eyes dwindles. He takes a deep breath and lets out a pained exhalation. He puts the rod down on the driver's seat.
"Look, I'm sorry. I understand how you feel, but it's better this way. Without electricity, that place is going to be a walk-in freezer by mid-November."
Nick keeps looking down.
"Yeah, I guess I see your point."
"It's better this way, Nicky."
"Sure."
At this point, Brian tells Penny he'll be right back, and he pushes himself off his seat. He moves up the aisle, staying low, moving just beneath the level of the sliding windows, until he joins Nick and his brother.
"What's the plan, Philip?"
"We'll find some place we can build fires. Can't build fires in an apartment building."
"Nick, how many more of these safe zones have you got mapped out?"
"Enough to get out of this part of town if we catch a break or two."
"Sooner or later, we're gonna have to find a car, though," Brian says.
Philip grunts.
"No shit.
You think there's gas in this bus?
Diesel, probably.
Guess it doesn't matter what it is. We got no way to siphon it.
And no way to store it, Philip reminds him.
And no way to move it, Nick adds. That metal thing over there.
Brian points at the metal reacher on the driver's seat.
You think that thing's sharp enough to puncture the gas tank?
On the bus?
Philip glances at the steel rod.
I suppose. What good's that gonna do?
Brian swallows hard. He has an idea. One by one, they each quickly slip through the accordion door and into the rain, which has now settled into a low, cold drizzle. The daylight is muddy. Philip carries the steel rod, Nick the three brown Miller Lite bottles that Brian found wedged under the rear seats. Brian keeps Penny close. There are dark figures visible in all directions. The closest ones may be a block away, and the clock is ticking. Every few moments, the lightning turns the city magnesium bright, illuminating the dead coming from either end of the street. Some of the biters have noticed humans scurrying around the back of the bus, and those zombies approach now with a more defined purpose in their lumbering gait. Philip knows the location of the gas tank from his days as a truck driver. He crouches down near the massive front tire, and he quickly feels under the chassis for the bottom edge of the tank as the rain drips off his chin. This bus has two separate reservoirs, each one containing 100 gallons of fuel.
Hurry, man, they're coming!
Nick kneels behind Philip with the bottles. Philip slams the pointed end of the steel rod into the bottom of the forward tank, but it only dents the iron enclosure. He cries out a garbled howl of white-hot anger and drives the point again into the reservoir. This time, the point punctures the skin of the tank, and a thin stream of yellow, oily liquid suddenly shoots out all over Philip's arms and hands. Nick leans in and quickly fills the first 12-ounce bottle. Thunder pounds the sky, followed by another salvo of lightning. Brian glances over his shoulder and sees an entire regiment of walking corpses. Closer now in the flash of heavenly daylight, only 25 yards away. Many of their faces clearly discernible in the photostrobe radiance. One of them is missing a jaw. Another one walking along with a streamer of intestines lolling out of a gaping hole in its stomach.
Hurry, Nick. Hurry!
Brian has pieces of a torn shirt ready to go in one hand, the lighter in the other. He fidgets restlessly next to Penny, who is trying her best to be brave, clenching her little fists, chewing her lip as she keeps tabs on the advancing army of upright cadavers.
There's one. Go! Go!
Nick hands the first bottle of fuel to Brian. Brian stuffs the rag into it, then quickly turns the bottle upside down until the cloth is soaked. This procedure only encompasses a few seconds, but Brian can feel the time running out, the presence of hundreds of biters closing in. A flick of the lighter produces a flame that is instantly extinguished by the wind.
Come on, sport. Come on, come on!
Philip is turning to the oncoming horde, raising his steel implement. Behind him, Brian cups his hands around the wick and finally gets it lit. The rag flares, the flames curling down the side of the bottle, feeding off the fumes and spill. Brian hurls the Molotov cocktail at the leading edge of the crowd. The bottle shatters 5 feet away from the closest zombies and blooms in a yellow sunburst of fire, making a crackling sound in the mist. Several corpses stagger backward at the unexpected light and heat, some of them bumping into their counterparts, knocking them over like dominoes. The sight of these monsters tumbling would ordinarily be almost funny, but not now. Now Philip grabs the second full bottle and stuffs the rag in.
Give me the ladder.
Brian hands over the bick.
Now get moving,
Philip commands, lighting the rag and hurling the flaming bottle at the army of monsters coming from the opposite direction. This time, the bottle lands in their midst, erupting in their ranks, setting ablaze at least a dozen biters with the ferocity of napalm. Brian doesn't look back as he scoops Penny off the ground and follows Nick in a desperate run for the barbershop. Brian, Penny, and Nick get halfway to the next safe zone when they realize that Philip is lagging behind them.
What the hell's he doing?
Nick's voice is shrill and frantic as he ducks into the doorway of another boarded storefront.
Hell if I know,
Brian says, ducking into the doorway with Penny gazing back at his brother. 100 yards away, Philip is yelling something obscene and inarticulate at the monsters, swinging his iron weapon at an attacker. The flaming zombie comes at him in a wreath of smoke and sparks. Oh, my God. Brian shields Penny's face. Get down. Get down! In the distance, Philip Blake is backing away from the mob with the lighter raised in one hand and the bloody iron raised in the other. Some kind of Viking brazenness taking over now. All his pent-up rage coming out in a series of big, portentous gestures. He pauses and lights a spreading pool of fuel seeping out from underneath the bus, and then turns and flees the scene with the full-tilt abandon of a ball carrier charging toward open field. Behind him, the puddle of fuel catches and spreads, the blue flames billowing toward the massive steel girth of the bus. Philip traverses about 50 yards of wet pavement, cracking the skulls of half a dozen biters along the way, while the fire crawls up the side of the bus. A low, subsonic thump rises above the rain and moaning noises. Philip can't see Brian and the others in the mist ahead of him. Philip! In here! Brian's howl is a beacon, and Philip dives toward the sound of it as the explosion rocks the ground and turns a dark gray afternoon into the surface of the sun. None of them gets a good look at it. They're all slammed against a door inside the boarded alcove, shielding their faces from the flaming shrapnel, pieces of the bus, jagged shards of metal bulwark, and fountains of glass flying past the doorway. Brian manages to glimpse a reflection off the glass of a store window across the street. The explosion, half a block away, has launched 20 tons of bus straight up, a mushroom cloud of dazzling, horrifying fire. The force of the blast bursting open the cabin, the molten hot shockwave punching through multitudes of dead with the violent brilliance of a supernova. Countless bodies swept away on the wave, incinerated in the furnace, some of them torn to pieces by the flying debris, the mortified body parts flying up into the storm-lashed sky like a flock of birds attempting to escape. A flaming piece of fender lands 15 feet from the doorway. Everybody jumps at the clanging noise, their eyes wide with shock. Fuck! Fuck! Nick exclaims, hand shielding his face. Brian holds Penny in a locked embrace, speechless, momentarily paralyzed. Philip wipes his face with the back of his hand and gazes around the doorway with the stupor of a sleepwalker just coming awake. All right, then. He glances over his shoulder, and then back at Nick. Where's this barbershop? Chapter 16. Half a block south, in the darkness of a festering, airless tile room, among scattered remnants of True Detective magazines, plastic combs, dust bunnies of human hair, and tubes of Brill cream, they dry their faces with towels and barber smocks, and then find more ingredients for homemade Molotov cocktails. Bottles of hair tonic get emptied and then filled with alcohol and plugged with wads of cotton. They also find an old, scarred Louisville slugger hidden under the cash register. The baseball bat probably once warded off unruly customers or neighborhood punks looking to boost the day's receipts. Now Philip gives the nascent weapon to Nick and tells him to use it wisely. They scavenge for any other supplies they might be able to use. An old vending machine in back yields a handful of candy bars, a couple of Twinkies, and an ancient sausage stick. As they stuff their knapsacks, Philip tells them not to get too comfortable. He can hear noises outside, more dead encroaching on the area, drawn to the explosion. The rain is slowing down. Noises are carrying. They have to keep moving if they're going to get out of the city before dark. Come on, come on. Philip says. Let's get our asses in gear and get to that Nick zone. Nicky, you take the lead. Reluctantly, Nick leads them out of the barbershop into the drizzle and down another row of storefronts. Philip brings up the rear with the iron bar ready to rock, keeping a watchful eye on Penny, who clings with simian instinct to Brian's back. Halfway to the next safe zone, a stray corpse lurches out from behind a wreck, shuffling menacingly toward Brian and Penny. Philip lashes out of the back of its head with the hooked end of the iron prod, hitting it just above the 6th cervical vertebrae, so hard that the cranium detaches and hangs down across its chest as it collapses to the wet paving stones. Penny averts her gaze. More cadavers are materializing in the mouths of alleys and the shadows of doorways. Nick finds the next painted symbol near the corner of 2 cross streets. The star is scrawled above the glass door of a small shop of some sort, The store's facade is draped in iron burglar screens, and other than a few frayed wires, broken neon tubes, and wads of gaffer's tape, the display windows are empty. The door is shut but unlocked, just as Nick had left it 3 days earlier. Yanking the door open, Nick waves everybody inside, and they enter in a hurry. In fact, they slip inside so quickly that nobody notices the shop sign over the door's lintel, the letters formed by dark, cold neon script. Tom Thumb's Tiny Toy Shop. The front of the store, barely 500 square feet, is littered with brightly colored debris. Overturned shelves have spilled their inventory of dolls and race cars and trains across the soiled tiles. A tornado of destruction has swirled through the shop. Wires dangle where mobiles once hung, the shattered plastic remains of Lego sets and planes piled here and there. The feathery stuffing of ripped plush toys stirs like dead leaves in the slipstream of the visitors slamming the door behind them. For a moment, they stand in the vestibule, dripping, catching their collective breaths, gaping at the startling ruins strewn before them. Nobody moves for the longest time. Something about the wreckage mesmerizes them and keeps them glued to the threshold. "Everybody stay put," Philip finally says, pulling a handkerchief and wiping moisture from his neck. He sidesteps a mangled, stuffed bear, and then he cautiously moves deeper into the shop. He sees an unmarked rear exit, maybe a stockroom, maybe a way out. Brian gently puts Penny down and checks her for any signs of injury. Penny stares at the sad rubble of decapitated Barbies and disemboweled stuffed animals. "When I ran across this place," Nick is saying from across the room, looking for something, "I was thinking they might have stuff we could use. Gadgets, walkie-talkies, flashlights, something." He moves around the end of the cashier's counter, up a few steps, and over to a perch behind the register.